The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post, AAA Go Magazine, and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in our readings. They are selected merely for your enjoyment and edification. Now, on today's Armchair Traveler, we begin our journey in Nevada, where writer Elizabeth Zack tells us about taking a gamble on a revitalized Reno. Her article is from the March 16, 2018 issue of The Washington Post. Midway through his 1940 Western classic, The Oxbow Incident, author Walter Van Tilburg Clark paints the barren Nevada landscape that is the backdrop to a lynch mob killing. He writes plaintively of snowy peaks, even in the summer months, of dried creek beds, meadows bedecked in purple and golden wildflowers, violets as big as the ball of a man's thumb, and timber to the tops of the hills. In late summer, you'd see a sheep herder, small out in the middle, with his burrow and dogs and flock. It was, he concludes, a lovely, chill, pine-smelling valley, as lonely as you could want. Oxbow is set in the waning years of Nevada's silver rush, a decade after gold was discovered in California, but during a time when cattle rustling could lead to vigilante justice. Oddly, though, I'd grown up in Northern California. I'd never heard of the book, nor much about the Comstock Lode discovered near Virginia City just south of Reno in 1859. I begrudgingly agreed to read the novel several years ago while living in Europe. Some German friends had eagerly asked me about it, assuming I was familiar with all things American West. Soon enough, not only was I sucked into Clark's tale of murder, but also in his vivid descriptions of a landscape I'd always dismissed as forgettable hinterlands, despite never having set foot in Nevada. When I moved back to California, I found that friends were swooning about the Renaissance that began around 2011. The city attracted companies like Apple, Amazon, Panasonic, and Tesla to move to Nevada with tax breaks. To satisfy its growing population of younger residents and families, and more retirees from California seeking cheaper living, new art galleries, a revamped river promenade, brasseries, microbreweries, and quirky areas such as the Midtown and Riverwalk districts have taken root and replaced some of the seedier landscape for which Reno is typically known. Last spring, I drove over the still-snowy Sierra Nevada range in search of that urban renewal and to see the rural vistas Clark had described so well. I figured that it might take some digging to mine modern Reno's figurative silver, but in this gaming town, I was more than game. I drove in and arrived at the stylish Whitney Peak Hotel, the city's first non-gaming, non-smoking hotel opened since 2011. Overlooks the prominent Biggest Little City in the World sign. After a scone and tea and some people watching at the cozy Hub Coffee Roasters, I strolled through the Riverwalk district that skirts the Truckee River, which was running wild after a banner year of rain that ended nearby California's epic five-year drought. Farther on, I pass Brian Tedrick's sculpture, A Portal of Evolution. First displayed at the Burning Man Festival in 2009, it now seems to be a Reno landmark and features a butterfly atop droopy blooms. But, by other accounts I heard here and there, it more resembles fallopian tubes. I frankly preferred a temporary exhibition of wistful Maynard Dixon landscapes at the Nevada Museum of Art, an impressive and imposing four-level structure inspired by Nevada's Black Rock Desert. Another fine exhibition featured modern and contemporary and political Mexican art and photography, including pieces by Diego Rivera and David Alfaro Siqueiros. Yet another detailed making of Swiss artist Ugo Rondoni's Seven Magic Mountains. Placed in the desert near Jean, the sculpture is an unmissable landmark of stacked limestone boulders painted in day-glow hues. I later wandered to the museum's Sky Plaza, where from a balcony I had a dreamy view of the snowy Sierras. Afterward, I found myself meandering southward from their base, more or less in search of Dixon's and Clark's landscapes. I think I found those in the vast and searing Carson Valley, where I languished a bit in tiny Genoa, the state's oldest settlement and, perhaps not surprisingly, home to its oldest bar. There, weary explorers, trappers, and pioneers, if they were lucky to have survived crossing the desert that stretches to Utah, gathered supplies and courage to then scale the looming Sierras, mostly in search of gold. Another day, I drove northward to Pyramid Lake, taking note along the way of a sign heralding a wild horse adoption center. The rocky, barren terrain enforced an unmistakable loneliness and uncertainty, but eventually both gave way to a bend to the anemic, yet striking lake and signature pyramid-like rock, Anaho Island, at its eastern shore. Aside from a handful of anglers at Warrior Point, the place was empty and the water like glass. I stopped by the marina to buy a sandwich and chips before parking alongside the fishermen's campers. Sitting near the shore, I watched them slowly wade in and patiently cast their lines. Later, while sipping pickin' punch, or orange bitters, at the J.T. Basque Bar and Dining Room in Gardnerville, an hour south of Reno, I asked Marie-Louise Luckenberry about Carson Valley back in the day. Her father, a Basque sheepherder, had settled in the area in 1947 along with many of his countrymen. He eventually opened a boarding house, which now houses the restaurant and bar. Marie-Louise and her brother run the place, and as she served me a hearty burgundy and homemade chicken and rice soup, she described how her father envisioned the boarding house as a home away from home for the lonely ranch hands by offering them the familiarity of the Basque tongue and cuisine. Marie-Louise's recounting of those long-gone days, her inadvertent evocation of Clark's sheepherder Small out in the middle with his burrowing dogs and flock, drew me back to Oxbow. Clark, I later read, was considered a Westerner because of all his tales of set in Nevada. In fact, he was born in Maine and only ended up in Reno because his father accepted a position as president of the University of Nevada in 1915. Clark settled on the East Coast as an adult and started his writing career there, but the Silver State's searing landscape with its wild yet tranquil terrain would inspire his imagination. In the brief days I traversed the eastern slopes of the Sierra Nevada, it inspired mine, too. And Zach, by the way, as mentioned, lives in Northern California. And accompanying the article is some tips on where to stay and so forth if you'd like to visit this part of Nevada in the Reno area. Where to stay? One of the suggestions, Whitney Peak Hotel, 255 North Virginia Street. And you can get online information at whitneypeakhotel.com, whitneypeakhotel.com. It's an outdoors climbing wall overlooking Reno's famous Best Little City moniker. And that would be reason enough to stay at this non-gaming, smoke-free hotel. The large, well-furnished rooms go from $160 per night. And where to eat? Well, Peg's Glorified Ham and Eggs at 420 South Sierra Street. And eatatpegs.com puts you in touch with more information online. Eatatpegs.com. Decadent Grilled Breakfast. How do you like that statement? Esquire magazine anointed Peg's as the best place in America to eat them. Have been served up here since 1999. Try the Huevos Rancheros. Breakfast entree start at $10. J.T. Basque Bar and Dining Room at 1426 Highway 395, Gardnerville. And online, it's jtbasquenv.com. jtbasquenv.com. B-A-S-Q-U-E. And the Nevada Icon offers family-style dining with a fixed dinner menu. Entrees, which include lamb shoulder steak, Basque chicken, and pig's feet with tripe and sweetbread, start at $25.95 per person. Now, what about to do? What to do? Well, Nevada Museum of Art at 160 West Liberty Street. NevadaArt.org gets you more information online. That's NevadaArt.org. The museum, founded in 1931 and run only by outdoor landscape painters, explores and exhibits work reflecting the intersection between art and environment. The striking four-level building, which was designed by Will Broder and opened in 2003, is reminiscent of Northern Nevada's Black Rock Desert. Open 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursdays, closed Mondays, Tuesdays, and national holidays. Admission is $10, $8 for students and seniors, $1 for children ages 6 to 12, and under that, it's free. Now the basement. And you'll find the basement at 50 South Virginia Street and online at thebasementreno.com, thebasementreno.com. The underground of this former U.S. post office, built in 1933, is now a multi-use incubator for alternative and collaborative vendors, selling everything from organic fruit juices to leatherware. It's open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, and it's all free if you just want to drop by. And then there's the Raymond I. Smith Truckee Riverwalk, and you can follow the signs in downtown Reno or go online to check it out at renoriver.org, renoriver.org. The 121-mile river flows from Lake Tahoe northward to Pyramid Lake, but first makes a cameo in Reno and provides a nice backdrop for a pleasant stroll away from the casinos and nightlife. Then there's Carson Valley, about 57 miles south of Reno via Interstate 580. And you can check out that online at visitcarsonvalley.org. Visitcarsonvalley.org. An hour south and a world away with the gaping desert to the east and the formidable Sierra Nevada to the west. In the beautiful Carson Valley, you can hike, golf, fish, ride horseback or in the back of an ATV, or even levitate by hot air balloon for a grand view. Stop midway in Virginia City for a glimpse of the Old West where Mark Twain got his start, or head for quiet in pretty Genoa, Nevada's oldest settlement, home to its first bar. Pyramid Lake, that's about 40 miles northeast of Reno, and online you can check them out at pyramidlake.us, pyramidlake.us. The barren landscape, located 25 miles north of Reno, eventually opens up to the Paiute Indian Reservation and Pyramid Lake. You can fish, $9 per person, check in at the ranger station in Sutcliffe, and camp, $9 per vehicle per night here, or just have a picnic lunch while taking in the view of Anaho Island, a sanctuary for the ubiquitous American white pelicans. Lots of fun around Reno, Nevada, so think about that one, huh? Well, since we're already in the Old West territory, why don't we just mosey over on to Texas, where the San Antonio Tricentennial remembers the Alamo and much more. Our guide's going to be Associated Press writer Beth J. Harpass, and her article is found in the April 3rd, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. San Antonio, Texas is remembering the Alamo along with the rest of its history as part of a 300th birthday celebration. The city was founded in 1718 when Spanish settlers built the Mission San Antonio de Valero, today known as the Alamo, along the San Antonio River. In 1836, the Alamo was the site of a legendary battle as Texas fought for independence from Mexico. A tricentennial commemorative week is scheduled for May 1st to May 6th. For visitors, May 4th will be of particular interest with arts events, a festival, and fireworks. For travelers who'd like to see San Antonio but can't make that week in May, the city is hosting exhibitions and other festivals throughout the year, and you can visit the Alamo anytime along with the Riverwalk just across the street. Tricentennial Commemorative Week. The Alamo and four other 18th century missions built as outposts of Spain's colonial empire make up the only UNESCO World Heritage Site in Texas. The Commemorative Week kicks off May 1st with a day of reflection on San Antonio's diversity and heritage that includes recognition for the indigenous Payaya people who inhabited the area before Europeans arrived. A candlelight vigil and sunset services will take place on the city's main plaza with citywide ringing of church bells. A visual story about San Antonio's founding called the Saga will be projected on San Fernando Cathedral's facade that night and other times that week. May 2nd is themed on history and education with events at libraries and schools. On May 3rd, Founders Day, college campuses host fairs, speakers and shows in Morgan's Wonderland, an amusement park designed for children with disabilities, celebrates the inclusiveness with free admission for all. The park also waives admission for visitors with disabilities. May 4th, themed on Arts for All, is the best day out for out-of-towners to join the celebration. Arts venues will offer free admission 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., a sculpture gift from the mayor of Mexico City called Alas de Ciudad. Wings of the City will be dedicated as the Tower of the Americas, and a festival will take place across a 5-mile route linking the missions along the river with music, entertainment, and fireworks. May 5th, we'll see the opening of a new linear park downtown, bringing the San Pedro Creek back to life with public art and green space. May 6th will focus on military appreciation appreciation. In addition to a rich legacy of military history, San Antonio is home to more than 80,000 active duty personnel and some 250,000 military retirees. Military facilities include Fort Sam Houston, Lackland, and Randolph Air Force Bases, and Camp Bullis. Fort Sam Houston will open to the public May 5th and 6th for the first time since 9/11. Planned events include a parachute demo, flyovers, marching bands, and a cavalry reenactment. Then there's ongoing exhibits and annual events. Tricentennial-themed exhibitions include Common Currents, featuring 300 artists who each created a work inspired by a single year of San Antonio history, displayed at downtown cultural centers and arts venues through May 7th. The Witt Museum hosts Confluence and Culture, 300 years of San Antonio history through January 6th. The San Antonio Museum of Art has two heritage-themed shows, San Antonio 1718, Art from Viceregal Mexico, featuring art from San Antonio's first 100 years through May 13th, and Spain, 500 years of Spanish painting from the museums of Madrid, June 22nd through September 16th. Annual events include the massive, colorful Fiesta San Antonio, April 19th through 29th, which started in 1891 as a parade honoring heroes from the Alamo and the Battle of San Jacinto. The Tejano Conjunto Festival, May 16th through 20, celebrates a unique cultural melange of Mexican, Spanish, Czech, and German music and dance. The Culinaria Festival, May 17th through 20, is a food event that also showcases wine from the Texas Hill Country. The Texas Folklife Festival, June 8th through 9th, or 10th rather, celebrates food, music, dance, and crafts of the state's more than 40 ethnic groups. The Balcones Heights Jazz Festival runs July 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, and a World Heritage Festival celebrating the mission's designation takes place September 5th through 9th. So there you go. Lots of fun down in Old Texas and around San Antonio, so you can remember the Alamo in a very special way, right? You know, one of the great stories of U.S. history is the introduction of the railroad. Countless stories abound about how the railroad bridged east and west, creating not only a new chapter in the life of the United States, but also an ongoing story of how railroads have built and linked communities across our nation. In the March-April 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine, the editors offer historic rail adventures with Amtrak vacations. Now, you might want to check out one of these rail destinations as a possible vacation for you. Few vacation experiences evoke that feel of nostalgia like train travel. The connection between our nation's national parks and the train has always been very strong. America's early railroad companies were instrumental in creating our national parks. For example, because of their energetic public relations efforts, the Northern Pacific Railroad aided in the national park designation of Yellowstone in 1872. The Southern Pacific Railroad worked behind the scenes to help Yosemite and Crater Lake obtain their national park statuses in 1890 and 1902, respectively. Also, the Great Northern Railway paved the way for the creation of Glacier National Park in 1910. Because of this connection, Amtrak vacations and national parks are an ideal combination. Each national park provides a distinct and memorable experience. Grand Canyon National Park. Grand Canyon National Park is home to unique combinations of geological colors and shapes carved out over millions of years of history that dazzles visitors, and a trip aboard the Southwest Chief is a bucket list experience. Your Amtrak train will drop you off in the historic town of Williams, where you will then board the Grand Canyon Railway, combining two of the best rail experiences. On to Glacier National Park, deep valleys and ancient forests and alpine scenery are only part of what Montana's Glacier National Parks utterly incredible. With Amtrak's Empire Builder, you'll travel from Chicago to Seattle with stops along the way. The Amtrak station in Glacier National Park is located less than 300 steps away from Glacier Park Lodge, making it the most hassle-free way to travel. Now we move to Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone is America's oldest and largest national park. Here you'll find more than 300 geysers, including Old Faithful, and hundreds of species of wild birds and exotic plants. Enjoy flexibility with a rail and transfer combination. Spend a few nights in Salt Lake City before taking your transfer up to the park, where you can choose among varied accommodations. And then there's Yosemite National Park, a designated World Heritage Site. California's Yosemite National Park is famous for its ancient plant sequoias, or giant sequoias, I should say, soaring granite cliffs and tumbling waterfalls. Amtrak Vacations makes it accessible to everyone with a transfer from San Francisco to the park, so you can experience both the bustling city and the natural ease of the park. And one more stop, Rocky Mountain National Park. Rocky Mountain National Park includes a major mountain range in western North America that stretches more than 300 miles from the northernmost part of British Columbia and western Canada all the way to New Mexico. This popular destination is especially known for hiking. Mountain biking and skiing. The tectonic activity and erosion over time by glaciers have sculpted the Rockies into dramatic peaks and valleys. Exploring our national parks by rail is a great alternative to traditional travel options, and Amtrak Vacations provides a personal adventure for anyone seeking to check off their bucket list destinations. There you go. Oh, my. Well, our next stop on today's Armchair Traveler is the National Civil Rights Museum. Kathy M. Newbern and J.S. Fletcher are leading the tour. Their article found in the March 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine. An emotional roller coaster awaits at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. Visitors often react strongly to exhibits where they can step onto the bus with Rosa Parks and hear the driver bark, "Please move to the back of the bus. I need that seat now." Sit across from the four African-American college students who were refused service in 1960 at the Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and learn about sit-ins that soon followed in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and other locations. See the battered, burned 1961 Freedom Riders bus and hear the "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech, Dr. Martin Luther King's last. Yet most powerful and moving is the silence as people reverently pass alongside rooms 306 and 307, just as they were when Dr. King and those accompanying him spent their final hours before the unthinkable occurred. 50 years. The museum was established in 1991 and comprises two buildings, the former Lorraine Motel, where 39-year-old King was assassinated, and the Legacy Building, formerly the boarding house from which the assassin fired the fatal shot. This year marks the 50th anniversary. A permanent wreath marks the spot where King was standing on the balcony in front of room 306. Yes, the museum pays tribute to the man who fueled the civil rights movement, but the movement itself is the message, more current than ever. For the 50th, instead of dwelling on King's death, the focus is MLK 50. Where do we go from here? The title of his last book, as well as a 1967 speech he delivered at the 11th Annual Southern Christian Leadership Conference Convention. The museum's Faith Morris said, "Dr. King addressed poverty, fair housing, employment, nonviolence, justice, education." She repeats his words, "Where do we go from here?" poignantly adding, "Civil rights is not a spectator sport." The museum's World in Transition Gallery reminds visitors how things have changed, yet remain the same. The dream continues. In the Lorraine Hotel, 24 permanent exhibits begin at the year 1619 with the global impact of slavery and end with a view of where he spent his last hours on Earth. Hundreds of artifacts and photos enliven learning, while numerous film clips captivate and evoke raw emotion. The museum not only chronicles a tumultuous period, but encourages involvement through its Join the Movement exhibit, where smart table touch technology allows visitors to take a stand on nonviolence, women's rights, war, riots, poverty, and integration. A $27.5 million renovation in 2013 and 2014, including 40 new films, oral histories, and interactive media, resulted in a one-of-a-kind experience that has received numerous accolades. On April 4th, 2018, there will be speakers, presentations, laying of a wreath, and a moment of silence. But the emphasis will be on living King's message, a positive change. So very, very interesting museum awaits if you head toward Memphis and so in western Tennessee. And let's take a look now on our next stop. Before we end our journey today, what we want to do is stay closer to home and take a look at some triangle attractions that dominate North Carolina's top 10 list. Now, this was written by Abby Bennett and appeared in the March 13, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. North Carolina is full of attractions and some of the most popular in the Triangle. For the fourth year in a row, the North Carolina Museum of Science, Natural Science, is the state's most visited attraction with 946,486 visitors in 2017. The Triangle is home to half of the top 10 in the North Carolina Museums and Historic Attractions Survey by Carolina Publishing and Associates. Four of those are in Raleigh. Fort Macon State Park in Atlantic Beach ranked as the second most visited attraction with 896,682 visitors last year. The 2017 survey is the 14th annual ranking. Asheville's Biltmore no longer reports attendance totals and is not included. The top 10 in order are, number 1, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, Raleigh, and again the visitors last year, 946,486, Fort Macon State Park, Atlantic Beach, 896,682 visitors last year. Number 3, Fort Fisher State Historic Site, Curry Beach, at 871,676 visitors in 2017. And number 4, North Carolina Zoo Asheboro, had 860,148 visitors last year. Number 5, Discovery Place Charlotte, 715,453 visitors in 2017. And I want to point out about Discovery Place, this is a very unique museum that I got to see shortly after it opened years ago. And my wife, when she was teaching, would take her classes by train, which the terminal was just a couple of blocks away from Discovery Place. They'd get out, they'd ride the Carolina, I think, or Carolinian, I believe the train was called, from Raleigh out to Charlotte and get off and just walk a couple of blocks and spend the day at the museum, get back on the train and have fun coming home. So it was a great way to travel. Number 6, Marbles Kid Museum, which is here in Raleigh. They had 690,629 visitors last year. Number 7, North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh, 579,236 visitors last year, and they're just next door to the Natural History Museum. And let's see here, North Carolina Museum of Life and Science, Durham, 574,884 visitors last year. And then number 9, North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, 495,696 visitors in 2017. And finally, number 10, North Carolina Arboretum, which is located in Asheville, and they had 494,532 visitors in 2017. So there you go. Definitely lots of places to see in the Triangle area and other parts of North Carolina. And as we get ready to close out, let's go to the travel calendar in the April 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine, see what's ahead. Just celebrating on April 21st, Earth Day in Aiken, Newberry Street, Aiken, South Carolina. They had a 5K run, a family bicycle ride, and other activities. On to April 28th, Greater Cleveland Chamber Strawberry Festival Technology Drive, Johnston County, North Carolina, right next door to Wake. They'll have tons of family fun and lots of strawberries, and the whole event is free. Want to check it out? Check out the GreaterClevelandChamber.com, GreaterClevelandChamber.com. And April 28th, we have the Lincolnton Food and Wine Brew Fest in downtown Lincolnton, North Carolina, featuring North Carolina wineries, craft breweries, fine art, and live entertainment, all free. There's no admission charge. LincolntonFoodWineBrewFest.com is where to find more information online. LincolntonFoodWineBrewFest.com. And that brings us to an end of another episode of Armchair Traveling. We hope you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, Triangle Reading Service. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.